4:45 a.m. is wake up. 5 to 5:15 a.m. is 108 bows. 5:30 to 6 a.m. sitting. Continuing now, 6 to 6:45 chanting. 6:45 Kong An reading. 7:15 breakfast in the dining room. 8 to 9 work period, cruise in the kitchen, house, and garden. This little one, we should prop this table up because it's gonna, if they try to lean on it.
We'll begin this morning with Geshin Nyoko leading a sitting and giving her talk, which as we promised last night is on women and Buddhism in America.
In the meditation was a chant that is one from the Tibetan tradition, and maybe many of you are familiar with it. It's Om Mani Padme Hum. I do this very often with large groups of people before a lecture or a meditation, because it is a simple chant that everyone can memorize and do. And we do it in taking a deep breath and then chanting Om Mani. Then we take another deep breath and chant Padme Hum. And we do it 3 times together, and then from there go into a silent meditation, which I will end with the ringing of the bell. To see some men here. I am always at a loss for a title for my talks because I don't prepare talks. I never know what is going to come through. So I thought it was easiest just to take the theme of the conference. Then I could say maybe anything. The truth is that I don't know anything about women and Buddhism in America. The only woman I barely know is this one. So really when I talk, I can really only talk about myself. And I think this is truthfully any one of us can really do. Whatever we do and look at is really self looking at self. Whenever we look at a thing from a certain vantage point, it is to the exclusion of all other aspects of that thing. That means it is not the total aspect of a thing. So when we simply talk as women about women in the relative world, it would not be the Buddhist practice or the Buddhist way. Because after all, what Shakyamuni Buddha revealed to us as the way is the way out of discrimination and conflict. And therefore, he was a liberator, not a person that gave us more problems in the world. And in fact, when we look at the universe, or what you might call the Dharma or ultimate reality, there are no problems. All problems are man or woman or human made. And therefore, they can only be resolved by us. We have individual karma. We also have collective karma. And certainly, we must look at, if we think we have a problem, we have to look at it from various positions or dimensions. One of the problems of communication in the world, I see, is that people talk from different dimensions or levels, and they assume that they're all speaking on the same level. I went to a conference once at a college, in Roanoke College in Virginia, and I was one of three speakers. The conference theme was Beyond Apathy. The organizers first called it apathy, and then they thought that it was too dismal, and they called it Beyond Apathy. When I arrived, there was a sequestered meeting for 3 days, and the last day it was open to the general student body. And in these sequestered meetings were 20 panelists. We were sitting in a circle, and for 2 days, I merely listened to the papers that these various panelists had brought to the conference. And their understanding of the problem of apathy in universities. The panel was made up of local clergy, politicians, and business people, as well as faculty from the university. The leader was the dean of the chapel. And after 2 days, they noticed that I hadn't said a word the whole time. So they asked me if I didn't have to say anything to this. And I said, well, actually, my preparations for this conference are quite different from yours. I noticed you all brought well-prepared papers, and I do just the opposite. I sit in the morning in my room and I try to forget everything that's on my mind. So I come here actually with an empty mind. I have no opinions or views. I really even don't know what apathy is. But I was able to hear you all talking. And what I hear is this: you're talking this way and that way and that way, and you really don't meet. because the complaints were the businessman's children had left home, it was during the hippie time, and they were not interested in his business. They despised his big home and Cadillac, and he felt threatened by that. The politician, who was a woman, also had complaints because the students were not interested in her particular form of politics. And so it went on with the churches and so forth. Now, most of these panelists, of course, lived in town and slept in their homes. A couple of other speakers had requested hotel rooms. I was offered a room on campus in a dormitory, a little apartment. And so I spent my time with the students and having my meals with them. And I found them a most lively and interested bunch of people. Of course, they took great notice of me in my outfit. And so we had wonderful conversations together. And I really did not have the impression that they were apathetic. So I told the panel, and I said, what I noticed, though, is that they do not share your particular programs. They have their own ideas of their lives. And maybe you should look at their ideas and see if there isn't anything you can share and not feel threatened by the fact that they don't buy your religious and political programs. And in fact, I said, the children, your children that have run away from home are living in our sin centers. So I could tell them a little bit about what their kids were really into, or some of them. And I think that the problems we create in the world is when we get stuck on anything that can be a thing or an idea, concept. And, you know, the Buddha, he was in the same situation that we are in. He was faced with a religious and social structure that didn't sound right, didn't feel right to him. So he questioned it. But he had also no role models. He went, therefore, alone to sit by himself under a tree. He left even the religious community he had joined, and he went out by himself. So did Jesus. Even though we see Jesus usually as nailed to the cross, I tell the Christians, you forget that he spent 40 days in the desert. What did he do there? He meditated. He was alone. Every Zen master has emphatically told us, or is telling us, that only your own inner reality must be looked at, not to seek anything externally. And that everything, in fact, every knowledge, every science, every wisdom we have in this world comes out of meditation. If you look at anything at all in this world and you trace it to its source, you must end up doing zazen. And that's the path I have taken. I have to say, though, that in my particular case, it evolved sort of naturally. I naturally meditated as a child and later on spontaneously. And then later, about 17, 18 years ago, I learned about the particular form of zazen. But I did not come to zazen because I was searching, but as a result of experiences I had. And I found then the way of the Buddha to be identical with my experiences, and I could relate to it. And not so much in the way this way has been developed by various traditions and various cultures, but I have a tendency to always go back to the origin, to the root. And you can do this in stages. First you examine maybe the roots of your own lineage or tradition. Then somehow I have always felt closer to the Chinese masters than to the ones in my own lineage, which were Japanese. But because I see Zen, the beginning of Zen in China, and I can relate to that because we have the same situation here. And I go back to Buddha's beginning and to the beginning of Jesus Christ or any other prophet in this world. The way is the inner path. When we look at something, we must look at it at least from two positions. And one that we naturally do is the one of the relative world, the what we call the common or ordinary, or let's say in the world of phenomena or manifestation. And most people in this world only take that position, ignorant of the fact of the underlying essence of this or the truth, as I don't have to tell you because most of you are practicing Buddhists know very well, that we call the ultimate reality or the absolute or the unborn or the Buddha nature. Of course, we all know that in this absolute there is no discernment whatsoever. Nothing is distinguished. There is equality. So how can the Buddha, who profoundly realized this and lived it and gave us a living example, then be said to have made rules that discriminate between this and that? The discrimination and that which we have maybe in scriptures which give us problems were made by others later. You all know probably this, the beginning of the women's liberation during Buddha's time. You know that in the pre-Buddhist era, women had no place in society. They were wives meant to bear sons to their husbands. If they didn't bear a son, the husband was free to take another wife that might bear him sons, because the prevailing view was that only a son can close the dead father's eyes. In the Hindu tradition, Manu, the law of Manu, was that a woman is first subject to the father next to her husband, and when the husband dies, to her son. Now, it is at that time and that place in history that the Buddha, this Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, appeared and liberated women from this slavery. In the Dharma, there is no discrimination of sexes, of anything. However, in the world of form, where this essence manifests as form, there are differences. There are men and women and many millions of other manifestation forms. So what we have to see is simultaneously that which is equal and free from any discrimination, but in its manifested form, equal and yet different. So the Buddha liberated women, and it is said that he always addressed his assembled followers with something like men and women of good families, or maybe in good English it would be ladies and gentlemen. It was probably highly unusual of any spiritual leader at his time to do this. He ordained women, not readily at first. At first he declined it. Not because he considered them not capable, but because he foresaw physical and problems of women in that time in India to travel around in the countryside, because they did not have established monasteries, they did not have housing for the monks. So there were many practical reasons, and merely out of a desire to protect women, not to expose them to hardships, he first took that position. However, you know, our beloved Venerable Ananda, his cousin, who had a great heart for women, when he saw the Buddha's stepmother, foster mother, and his wife appear with bloody feet and shaved heads because they had walked a great distance to join the Buddha and his Sangha, and begged to be admitted to the Sangha, that after the Buddha had declined, Ananda, in his wisdom, sought another approach. He then asked the Buddha, "Venerable Lord, are women capable of reaching nirvana and arhatship?" And the Buddha had to say, "Yes, they are capable of the highest attainment." And then Ananda made another push for his point, and the Buddha admitted his foster mother and his wife as the first ordained nuns to the Sangha. He gave them a set of special rules, which were based upon the situation and the conditions of the Sangha at that time and place. And it is said these rules were made for the protection of the men. Not because you thought the women were weak, but because the men were weak. All of the rules that evolved during Buddha's time were not made by him when he came out of his enlightenment and said, "All right, this humankind needs a set of rules to live by." He first proclaimed the truth, the Dharma, the equality of all things, the impermanence of all things, and cause and effect. As they were living together as a Sangha, certainly being incompleted human beings, certain situations arose and regulations were made in accordance with these arisen circumstances. So the rules and regulations that we have today for the Sangha are really rules and regulations that were made at a specific time for specific circumstances. And if you study Buddhism deeply, if you study the Prajnaparamita Sutras, which is at least one of the texts that we study in the Zen tradition, the Great Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, you will find here that the Buddha instructs his disciples, which he calls the Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, the enlightened beings, great beings, which really is every one of you, because we are all on that same path, whether we are aware of it or not. He instructed them in this way. A bodhisattva does not have the notion of a person or a being. A bodhisattva does not take his stand on anything. So that means for us what? We should not have the notion of a person or a being, a woman or a man. We should not take our stand on anything. That is the highest path. That is the path of transcendental wisdom. Of course, the Buddha taught also individually. He taught in accordance with the circumstances and the needs and the realization of individuals. Therefore, we have many parables, many examples of how he instructed people. We also know from that the Buddha did not only instruct with words, he gave them koans, he gave them a practice to do. And he had a way of, if you read the sutras, like the Diamond Sutra, of extrapolating the question from the questioner, of asking back again and again a question. For instance, in the Sarangama Sutra, he asks, Ananda, is the light of the lamp coming to your eyes or your eye going to the light of the lamp? Is the sound of this bell to know anything at all, we must go beyond the thing. And as I said last night, if we want to really know what Buddhism is for us in America, we have to sit down and forget both the old and the new. We all come, those of us who practice, from a tradition. And for the first time, I think, maybe in the history of Buddhism, we have a situation where we have all traditions in one country. So in the United States, we have the possibility to explore and experience every tradition that has been developed in Buddhism. The Tibetan, the Chinese, the Korean. And if you don't have them here, come to Los Angeles. We have all of them there. That is also maybe what is partly confusing to a lot of us. That we hear this kind of interpretation and that kind of interpretation. We see many different robes, many different languages that we chant in. So we have to sit down and look at ourselves. And I looked at all of this, and when you are in one tradition, trained in one tradition, there's a tendency to think that this is the way. And I think this is one of the hindrances of Buddhism in this country, that on the one hand, we have all these many traditions, which is a benefit and can be a great experience and education for us. But on the other hand, there's a tendency among these teachers and of course it is their calling to continue that lineage, that tradition, which this I understand very deeply, and I was involved in that myself. I see a need for that. I see a need, their need, to continue their lineage and tradition. But at the same time, what is tradition? How do we get traditions? By breaking traditions, right? Why do we have Rinzai then? Because Rinzai was different from Umon and Joshu and other masters. There were flourishing schools of Zen, all established themselves as a tradition. When you look at how Buddhist monks dress, you can see in every country they have evolved their own style of robe or interpretation of what the Buddha designated as the proper clothing for a monk. Incidentally, when I say monk, I mean both male and female monks. And therefore, we also must look at ourselves and see what is most appropriate for us. In terms of women and society, when we look at history as a whole in the last 2,500 years, I think more change has occurred in the last 50 years and then in the 2,500 before that. The changes are more and more rapid. When I was a young artist, a student, I always had a difficult time to relate to ancient ways of painting, like to the Venetian school, to the Renaissance and all. I could see it, but I somehow did not feel very close to it. And the same is true, I think, in religion. Religion that remains in the churches and in scriptures is useless, because it's dead. We have to look at spirituality. And the law of Manu that was made for women in the Hindu world, and maybe some of the regulations that were made after the Buddha's death, need to be investigated from the spiritual point of view. Not from the letter of the law, but from the spirit of the law. The Buddha showed us the way. He really did not lay down anything. He did not even establish a monastery. At the end of his life, he said, if you want to do that, you can. That was not my calling. So each one of us is free. We are free to live the kind of life that we each want to make for ourselves. But freedom does not mean just willfully to do anything that comes into my mind. It is the freedom to be free from being stuck in the conditioned world and to be free to follow the Dharma, to be one with the Dharma. When the Buddha was awakened from his great samadhi, he said, now I have found the deathless. I am the Dharma. And he said, when you see the Dharma, you see me, the true Buddha. And when you see me, you see Dharma. This is my endeavor, my personal endeavor, to live that, up to that, as closely as I can. And what that means in my life is to become transparent. There's no greater joy than to strip yourself of all the stuff, to take everything off spiritually. And that you can only do when you have realized that which is indestructible, your true nature. That true nature cannot be talked down or talked up or destroyed or enhanced by anything. And therefore, you can become vulnerable. Because that which can be destroyed should go. That's what you want to get rid of anyway. So let them take it. I don't care what the Theravadan monks say about women. I don't care what the books say about women. I don't care. I have to live my life in my own conscience. And that has to be aligned with the universe. And that's the job I have to do in this life. That's my responsibility. That is my responsibility to myself, but in reality, that means I am taking responsibility for all of you. And actually that is the true meaning of the four bodhisattva vows we chant. I vow to save all sentient beings. That's an impossibility if you look at it merely from the relative point of view. But when you realize yourself, truly, you have realized all. And then you can stand up and say, like Jesus said, I am the way. No one comes to the Father or the truth, I mean, but through me, that means through the Dharma. The Buddha also said, I am the Dharma. Between heaven and earth, I am the only authority. Now, each one of you should get yourself into the position where you realize this and can manifest it in the world. Then we are free from notions of man, woman. We'll be humans. Humans that appear as male and female. Just comes to my mind now when when I was Oriental monks, incidentally when they say, when they talk about women, it always sounds more like we men. That's just a little pun on the pronunciation. Language is a very important factor in our conditioning. I don't know where the English word woman comes from. Maybe from wooing man. In many other languages, I don't know if there's another language that where the word woman or female contains a reference to man. There's usually a separate word for it. And so you see, maybe the minds of Americans or English-speaking people are more conditioned, or conditioned in a different way than they are in other countries. Now, I teach in Europe, and part of my teaching there is in the German language. And I realized just recently, when I give teshos on koans, in English, when we, you know how the koans are broken up into introduction, the case, the commentary, and the verse. Here, what is called the case, in German, is called Beispiel. Spiel is to play. And bei means next to it, or by, or side, or something like this. And when I looked at this, I said, oh, how interesting. And it came to my mind that also in German, when we speak of living, we say, das Leben spielt sich ab. Life plays itself off. The universe plays itself off. There is always the word of play in it. And I had a great awakening when this happened in the middle of a talk. And I said to all these German people, do you realize you have forgotten how to play? Now life is a drudgery. You work hard and this and you have problems. And then when we have a case like a koan, it is like another play that runs alongside of my play. That I look and say, okay, here's an example. Another play. So all koans really should be prefaced with this, life is like this. And then there comes this play of one incident. We are really here in this world to enjoy, to play with the universe, to enjoy our true nature. And when we enter upon Zen practice, it seems in the beginning so hard and so difficult. And particularly as it was in my case, I told you that I trained with men, strong, young men. And when I was in the Rinzai tradition, which is for some masters a tradition that has to do with a lot of power and shouting and beating. That's the general impression that people have of Rinzai tradition, right? So when I was first put in the position of being the leader in the Rohatsu, which is one of our major sessions in December, very severe, with very little sleep, a lot of sitting. We had about 50 people in the Zendo, and I had practiced maybe by that time 2 or 3 years. And my master asked me to take the Jigijitsu position. The first time, I had done this many times before, but this was my first Rohatsu responsibility. The first time I stood up from my seat, I never forget this experience, holding the keisaku, the stick, in my hands and preparing to make my rounds through the Zendo. I reflected on myself, and as I said, all my role models were male then, and in the Rinzai monastery, if there's the slightest move or even the sound of breathing, the Jigijitsu shot. Adieu. I don't know. That doesn't feel, you know, like I could do this very many times, or it doesn't feel right to me. This is not my nature. I don't have that kind of muscular and bone and psychic structure that requires this kind, that's required for this kind of action. So what do? I'm a woman in this. Is there any possibility for women here? How would a woman do this? I didn't have any woman to look at, so I had to look at myself. And while I was standing there, we usually stand for about 2 minutes or 3 minutes before we walk. I stood there and I thought, well, I was totally, utterly helpless. And then it came to me and it said, it is necessary to be firm and strong inside. But my nature is gentle and kind, so to be both. To be gentle and kind on the outside, but firm and strong inside, because you cannot let 50 people down on the third day when they all get crazy, confused, tired, or want to give up. You have to uphold them. I knew inside of me, not with shouting around in the Zendo, but with my own awareness and strength, with my own spiritual strength and practice. And I'm telling you this because from then on I knew my way very clearly within my limits. Because the Dharma, of course, is without limits. It's I have gone way over my time. Unbounded, I have no limits. But as a human being, I have limits. And I have particular limits as a woman. But to work within them, because the Dharma, after all self manifests as the female, as the male. And I would love to go more into this, how that works in the Dharma, but unfortunately, our time is up. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.